You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of The City of Man. Once again, we are doing one of our ancient asides, which means I probably should start off with something to the effect of, friends, Christians, humanists, lend me your ears, because today we're talking about the aftermath of the death of Julius Caesar. Joining me again is Jordan Poss, adjunct instructor at Georgia Technical Institute. And once again, I have to ask Jordan, did I get that right? It is Georgia Technical Institute.
Greenville Tech.
Greenville Tech. Man, yeah. I knew I was going to drop the ball on that one. That's what I get for not writing all of this out and just reading it.
No, it's good. I wish I could say I were at Georgia Tech, but no, I am content at Greenville Tech.
I'm one of those people. I lecture from like fully written out notes, so it's not written in front of me, so of course I get it wrong.
I feel you.
Yeah. But as we just said that we left off last time with the death of Julius Caesar. There seems to have been some idea that once Caesar was assassinated, once the tyrant is dead, the Republic will be restored and everything will be, you know, sunshine and puppies for the Republicans from then on. That doesn't happen. So we need to just sort of jump into what's the immediate aftermath of Caesar's assassination. What happens to the conspirators and what happens to the people who are on Caesar's side? Jordan, you want to jump into that? We didn't in advance work out who would be doing what. So if there's anything that either of us isn't prepared for, that's fine.
No, I ought to be able to do that. The immediate aftermath is that first of all, the senators involved in the conspiracy against Caesar's life are. They get the disappointment of the century, I think. I think they expect the and again, all of this, we should say at the outset, is somewhat controversial among historians. You know, there's multiple different sources from multiple different points of view. But what it looks like is that the conspirators expect the city to kind of rally to their tyrannicide, which is how they term it. And instead, they are roundly condemned for having killed, you know, the friend of the people, the hero of the people, Julius Caesar. So that thing goes south on them almost immediately. And the guy who's kind of left in the to sort of take command in the breach is Marcus Antonius, or Mark Antony, as he's remembered, thanks to the kind of English humanist tradition of anglicizing names, annoyingly, in my opinion. Mark Antony is kind of a lughead, honestly. I was, you know, kind of going over some of this with my wife just last night because I love telling these stories. He sort of Mark Antony was great. He's one of those guys who flourishes under really strong leadership, sort of the Peter principle for ancient Rome, right? He eventually is promoted to the point that he is incompetent. He flourishes under Caesar's command. He is a friend of Caesar. He's a very close associate of Caesar. Famously, one of the conspirators is specifically detailed to distract Mark Antony outside the theater, Pompey's theater, where the Senate is meeting that day, because Antony was also a bruiser and could potentially have thrown a spanner in the works for the conspirators if he was there to personally defend Caesar's life. That said, again, with Caesar out of the picture, Mark Antony tries to rise to the occasion and, as we'll see, ultimately kind of fails because he does not have that genius for leadership that Caesar does and under which he had originally flourished as Caesar's lieutenant. Antony is it's hard to assess, but he comes across as somewhat not dim-witted, but slower than Caesar, not as canny as Caesar, especially without, as you were pointing out in the last episode, the enormous the kind of enormous political facility that Caesar has, where military genius aside, and again, we can come back to that, have a throwdown on that one of these days, Caesar is a genius for the forum and for the Roman political system. Antony does not have that. You can see this in, for instance, the way that Antony, following the conspiracy or the assassination, the result of the successful conspiracy, some of the conspirators flee Rome. Antony, though, is noted for a few days later dining with them, being seen working with them in public, actually deigning to speak to them, not actually pursuing them out of revenge the way he was kind of expected to. You could charitably interpret this, and again, there are lots and lots of interpretations. This is fertile ground for conspiracy theories. It looks like he's trying to kind of play the Caesar card and be forgiving and try to win people over with magnanimity and clementia, right?
Right, so that's exactly what Caesar had done after beating, what is it, Brutus and Cicero,
right?
In the battle. They come over and all of a sudden they're buddies again.
Right, and all of Pompey's lieutenants who Caesar had welcomed back, people like that. And again, it's kind of a measure of the difference in capability between Caesar and Antony, and that this blows up in Antony's face. There are a certain number of rumors that maybe Antony was involved in the conspiracy. Very unlikely from our point of view now. But the fact that he is exercising clementia, he's I guess you could say his timing is all off. Doing it so quickly, you know, while Caesar's body is hardly cold, is kind of a bad move. Into the fray steps I think he's 19 at the time, right?
Yes.
Yeah, he's still too young to even run for the lowest office that we talked about a few episodes ago. He's not going to be eligible for Roman political office for 10 years. This is a distant nephew of Caesar's named Octavius. I was just thinking about this a minute ago, trying to sort this out in my mind so I wouldn't be embarrassed, but here we go. You remember the old 3D screensaver of pipes that would, like, right, fill your screen? Yeah, that is a Roman family tree at this time, so I can never quite remember the connection between Octavius and Caesar. It's through Octavius's mother, Attia, though. When Caesar's will is publicly read, it's taken from the security of the Temple of the Vestal Virgins, where it's safeguarded so no one can tamper with it. When his will is publicly read, he posthumously adopts posthumously adopts Octavius as his son. And again, this adoption is total in the Roman world. Octavius, from that point forward, is known as Gaius Julius Caesar, sometimes Caesar Octavius, just to kind of keep things straight. I'll keep calling him Octavius and eventually Augustus, again, just to avoid confusion. But he takes his dead adoptive father's name. He refers from that point forward to Caesar as his father. So this becomes personal for him. As he seeks revenge, he always does it in the name of the Republic and the name of his father, right, who was murdered by these people. No one really takes Octavius seriously at first because he's a kid. He's 19. Various descriptions of him from this time exist. He's apparently – we can probably talk about this more later on when we get to things like Actium, but he doesn't seem to have a particularly good constitution. He's described as having, for instance, weak legs, which is a problem in an infantry-based army. And he also seems to have some kind of psychosomatic disorder. Whenever the pressure really gets intense throughout his career, he has a recurrent series of very severe illnesses. At the time, though, he, with some runaround, does accept the adoption of Julius Caesar, and this is where the showdown, even though it's going to be many years coming, this is where the showdown between he and Mark Antony gets its roots. He kind of comes out of nowhere right here in the immediate aftermath of the assassination. Do you have anything you'd add to that?
Yeah, I mean, it really is I actually feel a little bit bad for Mark Antony. I guess I have a more charitable approach. I think he was put in a position that he didn't really want to be in, and he tried to sort of copy his mentor,
right,
and just wasn't up to the task, which we'll see exactly the same thing if we get to Tiberius today, we'll see exactly the same thing happen again.
Right. And I would agree completely. And where I would start to condemn Mark Antony, and, you know, with all the provisos in place, is when he eventually starts doubling down on his lack of success, which is going to come later.
Right. So Antony is, and there, like you said, there are some suspicious things going on. So one of the things he does is he shows up at the assemblies and at the Senate with a bunch of bills, you know, a bunch of proposed laws that he had found, you know, in Caesar's pockets or in Caesar's toga or whatever, that, you know, Caesar was going to propose before he was killed, which is exactly, I think, as believable as it sounds. Not least because one of those bills involved providing a bodyguard of several thousand men for Mark Antony, quite reasonably, he wanted a bodyguard after what happened to Caesar. I don't think you can say that's unreasonable. But there's still the idea that he's kind of ham-fistedly trying to copy Caesar in a way that's obvious. And then all of a sudden this Octavian guy shows up on the scene and throws everything askew. And Octavian, like you said, he catches everyone off guard, in part because he's so young. And in part, I think, because he's really not a genius in the same way that Caesar or that even to some extent Mark Antony is.
Right.
So you know, if Caesar is a political genius, who wants this military glory, and Antony is sort of his spiritual heir. You know, Antony's the guy who's trying to follow. Octavian, I think, is certainly the most brilliant and talented Roman administrator that we ever see. But, you know, nobody looks at a bureaucrat and says, oh, man, you're such a genius. even in their day, you know, no one thinks you shuffle paper amazingly well.
Right.
And yet, that's what's really necessary. Octavian is phenomenal. It's sort of seeing potential in other people, convincing them to get on his side, and then using that to his fullest advantage.
Right. Well, and while we're
I was going to go ahead.
I was just going to say, and while we're on the subject of Octavian's character, one important distinction that I've seen between he and his adoptive father Caesar, and one of the things that's going to set Octavian apart and possibly ensure the longevity of his rule, first as, you know, whatever exactly you call the heir of Caesar and eventually the emperor himself, is his ability to take advice. One of the big differences, probably the important difference in that no one – I think there were attempts on Octavian's life, but no one ever really succeeded because no one ever really seriously – you know, there was not enough wrong with Octavian to really prompt a large conspiracy like there was against Caesar – is that he was able to take advice, and he was not dead set on getting his way in every single thing. There were multiple times in which the Senate decided that they would stand up to Augustus later in his career, and Augustus backed down, which, again, is accrues to his credit, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah. He's if we struggle to, as we did in the last episode, if we struggle to articulate whether or not Julius Caesar is a good guy, I think that struggle is much easier with Augustus. You know, We can have arguments as to whether or not what he did politically was a good thing, but personally, I mean, this is a virtuous person.
Yeah.
By most accounts.
Right.
Yeah, in terms of his in terms of just his ability, you know, he immediately sort of ingratiates himself to basically everyone. So he shows up in Rome, starts speaking very kindly to Caesar's veterans, promising them generous retirement benefits. So there he's sort of getting the army on his side. With the army go the Roman people. So he's stepping into the populares slot, even though at this point those political factions are largely defunct. So he's kind of taking over politically from Caesar, but he also starts calling on the few remaining prominent senators. At this point, there aren't many of them left. Most of them have been killed in the civil wars or have fled to the provinces. But the few that are left in town, he starts showing up at their houses and asking their opinion on public policy and listening, like you said, very politely to their answers. And then publicly goes out and says things like, you know, I am delighted to endorse Senator so-and-so's plan to adjust the tax policy. Mm-hmm. The result is everybody starts to like Octavian.
Right. Just really quickly, it's also worth pointing out that where that places him in the spectrum of the Roman virtues, as a young man seeking the advice of his elders, he is engaging in a very, very public form of pietas, right? Which, you know, he's already got dignitas by virtue of who he is, by who his adoptive father is. But what he does with that inherited dignitas is going to depend very much on the choices that he makes. And by submitting himself to the older men, which is the old Roman tradition, he's making a good start for himself.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And doing so very publicly, right?
Yeah.
In a way that we don't really have any record of Caesar ever doing. I mean, Caesar went straight to the battlefield and got his glory that way.
Right.
Antony, to his credit, does not, you know, squash this impudent kid. Instead, he teams up with Octavian. I like the anglicized version of that. Octavian, I think, is better. So the two of them sort of agree that the real enemies are Brutus and Cassius, who are still raising armies in the east. And so they return to Rome. They get the popular assemblies to create a new set of offices. This is the triumvirate. So these new offices are triumvirs. So it's Antony, and Octavian and a guy named Lepidus, who is kind of a non-entity. If you've seen the Rome miniseries, the guy who plays Lepidus, I think, is just phenomenal. It's very well cast sort of across the board, but he is just this awkward kind of non-entity that every once in a while says something and everyone in the room just rolls their eyes and then goes on with what they're talking about. And it's just, it's really done well.
Yeah, the it is worth pointing out, though, the one thing that I don't know if you can call this to his credit. I mean, Lepidus is one of the very few figures from this time period who dies a natural death as a very old man. So that's worth considering. I mean, you look at Pompey, Crassus, and Caesar. Every one of them died violently. Mark Antony, spoiler alert, dies by his own hand. Augustus does manage to make it to old age, but that's on the backs of a lot of conquest, of course. Lepidus, even if he's kind of a non-entity, at least makes it out in one piece and dies a natural death, which is not something you can say for very many people involved in high office at this point.
Sure, sure. And I mean, at this point, Cicero, I think, is dead, right?
Cicero, well, that's worth pointing out, is the détente, for lack of a better word, between Antony and Octavian is not immediate. There seems to be some rumblings that this, you know, especially once Octavian has publicly accepted the, you know, Caesar's will. Caesar had left in his will a personal donation out of his vast fortune acquired through the conquest of Gaul. A donation of a certain amount of, I want to say it's like 200 or 300 sesterces, which is a decent kind of like bonus check to every citizen of Rome. And Octavian, even though he inherited Caesar's name, was blocked, I believe legally, from inheriting Caesar's fortune and actually dispersing those funds. So that started to seed some really serious tension between Octavian and Antony, like, immediately. Eventually they were able to smooth those things over, and as part of that were basically a new round of prescriptions. Like, I think at this point it was something like 40 or 50 years prior, Sulla and Marius, Antony and, for whatever reason, this is all a little jumbled here. Octavian, for whatever reason, had kind of gotten close to Cicero. Cicero had been immediately in the aftermath of Caesar's assassination, seen Antony as a new threat to the Republic, right? He was just going to make himself the next Caesar. And he delivered the very famous Philippics, right? These two speeches in which he savagely denounces Antony. Antony is going to that's a sticking point for Antony. It sticks in his craw, and as a point of pride, he has to do something about that. So when Antony and Octavian finally reach this accord between each other, one thing that happens is that Octavian seems to look the other way while Antony's agents catch up to Cicero and murder him.
With Octavian's blessing.
Right, basically. Famously, Cicero, and, you know, meeting a very, very Roman and stoic end, decides that, you know, he's an old man. He's just going to kind of wait for this sort of thing. So as he's attempting to leave his villa in Tusculum, he's caught on the road by some of Antony's agents, and he calmly sticks his head out of his sedan chair and exposes his neck for them to cut off his head. You know, just sort of embracing it, even though his slaves offer to fight for him.
Since we're on him for a second, I've got to ask thoughts on Cicero. We asked this about Caesar.
Yeah,
good guy, bad guy. What do you think? What do you think of Cicero?
There is so much of Cicero. I feel hesitant to talk because there might be, you know, some part of him that I'm overlooking. I have not come close to reading all of Cicero's works. What I have read, I have generally liked. A few weeks ago, actually probably close to a month ago now, as I was kind of brushing up on some of this, Finley Hooper's book, which I've recommended several times, had a really great one-paragraph rundown of Cicero's politics. And he said Cicero is kind of a novus homo, you know, a new man, the first of his line to actually step into these high offices. Kind of felt himself in tension. He was torn between kind of the pull of the people, whom he distrusted because of the perils of democracy and mob rule. But he also deeply distrusted the kind of old aristocracy who were primarily interested in their following their own interests. And so Cicero was kind of caught in this seesaw effect where he was kind of bouncing back and forth between trying to tamp down whichever half of the population he felt was sort of the gravest threat at the time. If it was the self-serving tyrants like Caesar, or who at the same time was also trying to buddy up to mob rule, that speaks pretty deeply to me, who simultaneously, I just to be really frank, I distrust democracy period, but I also do not believe in a rule by some sort of wealthy or technocratic elite. It's both of those ways lie madness, and I think Cicero felt that tension, which I deeply respect. He also did a lot of what he could to save the Republic, sometimes resorting to shady measures. He rammed through the execution of Catiline and some of the Catilinarian conspirators on questionable constitutional grounds, but I can at least respect his motives for it. I don't know. Your thoughts on Cicero?
I can probably count on one hand the number of complete works of his that I've read, and I think it's probably zero. So, I am in that sense not a great ancient world scholar. Cicero, from what I understand, he's sort of fallen out of vogue. Anyone who studied the ancient world, 40 years ago, they would have known Cicero backward and forward. And my grandparents, and I assume yours too, when they were in high school, if they went to high school, would have read Cicero.
Right.
Often in Latin, that has just changed. That's largely because, from what I understand, his Latin is spectacular.
Yeah,
there's a lot of it available. It's really well done, and it's just accessible, even in the original. So, because I am of that later generation when Cicero has fallen out of vogue, and it's much more popular to force Latin students to do what I had to do and read people like Suetonius and Virgil and Tacitus and all of these other impenetrable Latin writers. So it's just not as common. So I actually don't have as formed an opinion on him as I should. With that said, one of my favorite sayings in all of politics comes from Cicero's On Old Age, and I'm going to butcher the Latin, but it's quid loquar de utilitate stercorandi. I think that's right. I'll get it right in the show notes. It's in his work On Old Age, where he's reflecting on being a farmer and being a politician. Mm-hmm. And that sentence comes at the point where he's transitioning from talking about being a farmer to talking about being a politician. And you don't know, because it's Latin, you don't know which part it goes with. It just all kind of runs together. In Latin, there aren't even spaces between words. So
right.
Who knows where this goes? And I believe the exact translation is something to the effect of, what shall I say about the usefulness of spreading manure? And it's such a great line. So I love Cicero because of that, even as I know little about him beyond that. He's on my to read list.
Yeah.
It's just a ways down, because as he would have pointed out, he doesn't really do original political philosophy or anything. He's just copying these Greek things into Latin. Yeah.
Well, a good one, as long as we're on the subject, and to maybe jump the gun on our recommended reading a little bit, a good one with Cicero is De Officiis, or usually translated mm-hmm. on duty or on duties. That one pretty nicely sums up a lot of what Cicero has to say about particularly the political life. And just from the very title, you get a pretty strong sense of where he's coming from. He's talking about duties and obligations, which even the word duty smacks of pietas, right? Which is one of the things that I really love about him as someone of kind of a temperamentally conservative bent. I just really, really love Cicero. His respect for the past is commendable. At the beginning of every semester that I teach, I start off kind of to tell my students what it is we're going to be doing. I give them three quotations, one from Mark Bloch, one from L.P. Hartley, and the final one is from Cicero, and it's his line. I can't remember the source of this off the top of my head. It might be on duties or on old age, but I can't recall for sure. But again, there's like 50 volumes of Cicero and the Loeb Classics, sure. So sue me. He says that, you know, not to remember what happened before you were born is to be a child forever. You know, what is the worth of a man if his life is not enriched with stories of great deeds from a greater past? It's kind of the
kind of the opposite something that of the applies current, across the board.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's just obviously something that applies across the board.
Yeah.
It's like going to a church full of only college students, you know, what did they know about anything prior to, you know, 2012?
So, right.
Yeah. Actually, there are a couple that I have read that are not whole works, a couple of recent translations that are sort of snippets of his work. I forget the translator, but one of them is called How to Run a Country, and one of them is called How to Win an Election. They're both excellent, really well translated, and really affordable, which is nice.
He's got several – or there are several slightly older translations. They're all by Michael Alexander, who was kind of like the Rome guy in the 1970s, right. In the Penguin Classics, which I'll stump for again. They have a bunch of volumes of Cicero. Most of them are selections, which I kind of made my peace with because they are good selections. You're not going to read all of any particular book by Cicero in those selections, but they are they're kind of classed like with like. So there's kind of philosophical and theological treatises in a book called On the Nature of the Gods. I'd recommend them. There's also collections of his speeches, which are absolutely worth reading.
Right. Well, that's a tangent on Cicero, but I think a worthwhile one because Cicero is kind of awesome.
Especially as a measure of exactly what's going on. Cicero's sort of the old guard, and it's interesting. We'll see a little bit of this at play with Caesar Augustus's life too, I think, as kind of a guy who's sort of a newcomer, because Augustus's own lineage is not long and lofty. I mean, one of his grandfathers may have been a freedman.
He's still a Julian.
So, he's got that family tie, but not all of his family is illustrious. And by the same token, we're seeing newcomers to the grand political scene who in many ways have a lot more respect for what Rome has built than the old families, like, again, Julius Caesar. Caesar, you know, traces his lineage back to Venus, supposedly. Caesar is full of gloria and full of his own dignitas, not a lot of pietas there. Some of his gravitas is sacrificed because of his shenanigans behind the scenes, right? Cicero and Augustus, by the opposite token, are relative newcomers, but they're going to work really, really hard to make sure that they are worthy of old Rome, if that makes any sense.
It does, and that's – we talked about this a little bit last time. That's one of the things that's always sort of discouraging in the days when, you know, I'm more morose and thinking, oh, are we sort of at our – end of our republic stage, you know, we don't seem to have those characters like Donald Trump, the Clintons, and Bernie Sanders are not Cicero, Caesar, and Augustus.
Right.
They might be Catalans, but they're not, you know, they're not sort of these virtuous individuals. Even if they're bringing about the collapse of the country, it's not because of personal problems with them. They have all these personal problems, so. But that's for later. We're jumping again there. So where we sort of left off, we were into this collusion between Lepidus, Antony, and Octavian, where they form this new office. It's the last office of the Republic, the office of Triumvir. It is a sort of formal attempt to save the Republic by dealing with people who are in rebellion against it. Although, of course, if you'd ask Brutus or Cassius, were you rebelling against the Republic? The answer is no. They pretty handily deal with them. I don't know. I can't even remember the name of the battle that they fight, but I mean, it's a nothing battle. Right. I mean, there's never really a chance that that they're going to lose this, which means once that Brutus and Cassius are dealt with, the three of them are now free to fall back into infighting, which quickly happens. Mark Antony becomes friends with the son of Pompey the Great, a guy named Sextus Pompey, and starts causing problems for Octavian. This is sort of dealt with by the fact that Antony is married to Octavian's sister, So we have a parallel there with Julius Caesar and Pompey, right, where Pompey had married Caesar's daughter. Same sort of attempt is made here. It doesn't really work. Antony never seems to like Octavia, so that doesn't end up reconciling the two of them. He finally divorces Octavia and shacks up with Cleopatra. And then, according to Augustus, starts dressing like an Oriental sissy. Octavian sort of has all of this great rhetoric. Antony has, divorced my sister. And he's offended the dignity of my family. Good Romans don't divorce someone. Don't engage in divorce. They certainly don't engage in divorce so that they can move east and start to Orientalize. That may not be the right phrase here, but
Antony, with this Greek queen, no less, right?
Yeah, or even Egyptian queen, right? She is certainly Greek. There's no doubt about that. But she is queen of Egypt, which is kind of a double whammy, right? She's Greek and she's Egyptian.
The mysterious, weird East with all of their it's about this time that ISIS is starting to trickle into Rome, right? The cult of ISIS, not the.
not the terrorists. Although for the Roman, there may be no difference there. I don't know. There's a. That's one of those areas where research is, I think, still developing, although I haven't really followed it in a while now, so maybe it's fully developed.
It's the cult of ISIS, and we can talk about this probably more fully when we talk about kind of I think we mean to talk about the rise of Christianity within the Roman Empire later on down the road. But the cult of ISIS is certainly pretty firmly in place in the Roman world by the end of the first century. The novelist Apuleius in The Golden Ass devotes a considerable amount of time to talking about the cult of ISIS. As to exactly when it starts showing up, I would assume it's kind of following these encounters with the East, but who knows?
Right. Yeah, I don't know the dates there. I know there are a lot of arguments that try to tie it into Christianity.
Yeah.
But it's sort of a which comes first type thing, and I don't know the timeline well enough.
Yeah.
So we have Antony in the East raising legions. Again, in Antony's mind, he is doing exactly what Caesar had done, right? He goes east, originally in the name of preparing for an invasion of Parthia.
Right, which is what Caesar had been planning to do before he was assassinated anyway.
Right. So using Eastern resources, so not putting a drain on the city of Rome. Octavian back in the West is basically taking care of everything in Italy, feeding the population of Rome. Octavian sort of really shows his political brilliance. He meets up with Lepidus. Lepidus had been given command of Africa. He meets with Lepidus and convinces Lepidus to retire. Lepidus, as the commander in Africa, had control over the food of Rome. Lepidus apparently had no political ambition whatsoever, which, as you pointed out, probably saved his life.
Yeah.
he retired all of the legions that had been loyal to him, then go over to Octavian. It gives Octavian control of the food supply for Rome, which he then is very generous with. So this sets the showdown between Octavian and Antony. I don't know. Again, I don't know the military history. This is more your area. Is there ever really a chance that Octavian's going to lose this?
I don't know. I think it was maybe a bit more of a close run thing than we're tempted to remember. Especially with, and we'll talk about guys like Virgil later on down the road, if I remember correctly from the outline. The victory at Actium over Antony and Cleopatra is kind of a foregone conclusion in a lot of our minds. I think it was maybe a little bit closer because Cleopatra has the vast resources of Egypt to draw upon, which is primarily in terms of wealth, which means that she can, if they don't have enough troops, they could hire troops. She potentially has the resources at her disposal to create a very long and drawn out conflict, especially with the food that comes out of Egypt. Egypt is kind of the breadbasket. I mean, most of the food being consumed in Rome itself comes from Egypt at this point via grain import. She's got a powerful navy. She's got control of the food supply, a large part of it anyway, which means that if she so chose, she could starve Italy, which raises the stakes considerably as we're talking about this. It's not simply a military conflict. We're talking about, in the minds of both Antony and Octavian going into this, this is an existential struggle. A large fleet, lots of resources at her disposal. And again, Octavian is the callow youth in this equation. Even his trusted general, Marcus Agrippa, is also roughly his age, maybe a little bit older if I remember. So, I mean, we got a bunch of young bucks kind of facing off against a tried and true veteran, Mark Antony, right? Caesar's heir, spiritually, if not in point of fact through his will, who has, again, shacked up with Cleopatra, who is a very powerful Eastern potentate, to use a kind of old-fashioned word there.
Right.
I think it was maybe a little bit more near run than we would be tempted to believe. But and getting back to what I had been kind of talking about with Augustus personality-wise, I think one of the things that appeals to this period for kind of modern reimaginings, and I mean going all the way back to Shakespeare, who we all know Julius Caesar, but there's also a sequel, Antony and Cleopatra. The kind of gossipy quality to this. I mean, so much of this is political, but it is also very, very personal. Antony's snubbing of his wife Octavia is kind of an illustration of the collapse of traditional Roman morality that Augustus is in the future is going to do a lot to try to shore up, which we can talk about later. But also, again, that kind of orientalizing the word we've got in our outline, this kind of not only did he snub my sister to whom he was married, right? This, you know, for the good of the Republic, we united our families. He's snubbed her. He sent her home. He's neglecting his children, and instead he's running around with this, again, weird Eastern queen. If we lose, you could get a king again, because the guy who marries a queen, you know, dot, dot, dot. You want me to cover Actium then?
Just briefly.
There's not actually a whole lot to say about it. These are the stakes. The stakes are pretty cataclysmic, and this is going to kind of, even though he's not actually going to be declared Caesar Augustus for some years after this, Actium is really where Octavian becomes ipso facto the emperor after everybody else is kind of out of the way.
Right.
Before Actium, he has another one of his kind of episodes of illness. So as he approaches conflict, he's usually doing so with pretty good determination, but he very, very often becomes violently ill just before the battle. So that's when Marcus Agrippa takes over. Agrippa is one of these kind of unsung heroes, not as vividly realized in the popular imagination as maybe Caesar or Antony even. But Agrippa very, very capably sort of acts as Octavian's enforcer militarily. At Actium, it's a naval battle. They're able to cut off on land Antony and Cleopatra's forces, which are sheltering in a very large harbor. And so then they Agrippa draws up Octavian's fleet outside the mouth of the harbor. So basically, Antony and Cleopatra's fleet has no choice but to try to fight their way out and get to a place where they can stage a slightly more advantageous battle. There's a certain amount of waiting involved, but eventually they go into the attack, and the smaller, faster ships of Octavian's fleet under the command of Agrippa are able to sort of pick apart Antony and Cleopatra's fleet and destroy it bit by bit. This is where I think Antony and Cleopatra's real character shows, particularly Cleopatra's. The whole time that this has been going on, she's got a smaller fleet of very fast ships hanging back. This is her personal kind of corvette escort in naval terminology. She's waiting to see which way the winds are kind of blowing, and when it becomes clear that her fleet is being seriously defeated, she waits for a gap to open in the combat, and then they hoist sails and set them to the breeze and very quickly slip through the battle and out into the Mediterranean and are gone. Antony leaves the battle the same way. Regardless of what you think about Antony leading up to this, abandoning his army in the midst of their defeat is a pretty low point. And it's not long after this that even though they're widely separated, defeat becomes clear for both of them, and both of them wind up committing suicide, which leaves Octavian large and in charge, so to speak.
Yeah, so this is really the end. You know, Actium in 31 BC is really the end of the Republic.
Right.
At least we said last time that Sulla sort of establishes or reveals the principle that political power in Rome now comes from the army. So you could say that's the end of the Republic.
Yeah.
But at this point, there's really only one guy in charge. So
right.
maybe the Republic sort of limps along even after Sulla, because there are multiple people who can claim the obedience of the army, that ends in 31 BC. Which leads to the question, at the end of the Civil War, Augustus sort of takes the reins of power. Well, and then what? What happens to all those institutions that we spent a whole episode talking about? Well, if you ask Augustus, nothing, right? All he does is restore the Republic to what it had been before all of the Civil War troubles had started. There's something to this. There is something to what he's saying here. And I think if you need proof that Octavian is really a great man, the first thing he does after he has sort of sole power is he declares a general amnesty. Everyone who fought for Mark Antony, everyone who fought for Pompey the Great's son, gets forgiveness and gets a pension.
Yeah.
So they get land for their veterans as well as his own. He takes the loot that he has acquired in Egypt and uses it to buy land for them to settle on. And then he resigns. He sort of publicly says, "Hey, I've saved the Republic. I'm returning all power to the Senate and the people of Rome. I'm laying down my his official office." Then would have still been his triumvirate. So he lays that down. Even though the other Lepidus is already retired and Antony is dead, he still lays that power down. And in response, the Senate sort of spontaneously, quote unquote, spontaneously votes him the title of Augustus.
Yeah.
And grants him a proconsular imperium. That is, they give him back the power that he has just laid down. And that's kind of the end of it. He occasionally runs for office again. Every once in a while, he summons the Senate and asks for sort of exceptional powers, which he is granted, and then which he lays down once he needs them. And that's sort of the end of his formal activities in government, which raises the question, why do historians call this time the Roman Empire instead of, you know, just Republic II? Right? What's actually different here? What's going on that changes the way things are going? And I'll kick this over to you, Jordan.
Well, you're right to point out he gets a proconsular power, which he basically holds for life, right? I mean, right. In addition to that, he also has the power of a tribune, which, if you remember, the consuls and the tribunes previously were kind of the two uttermost points at which political discourse in Rome could ultimately butt heads, right? So if the power of both of these offices is combined in one man, that man can do or stop whatever it is that he wants to do. With this in mind, Augustus, personality-wise, his impulses seem to be, and again, read this in the lowercase c meaning that I mean here, his impulses seem to be basically conservative in that he's trying to shore up the huge and already kind of tottering empire. He recognizes that there are weaknesses. These have become very, very clear in the last couple of generations by this point, where fault lines have appeared between very strong men with very powerful armies. He wants, if possible, to prevent recurrences of that. And one of the things that he intuits is that it's not just about political institutions, but it's about reestablishing the basis of the Roman character that made Rome great in the first place.
He is making Rome great again.
Yeah. Not building walls, because he has the Rhine, right?
Well, sort of.
Yeah. oh gosh. I didn't expect to get waylaid by Trump so soon in the morning. oh man. Trump is my Crassus. So let's put him out of the picture here. He's trying to, again, on a personal level, right? He already recognizes that Rome itself is great, but if it is going to continue to be great, it's got to be like that spurious Tocqueville quotation that goes around every once in a while. You know, if America ever ceases to be good, it will cease to be great.
Right.
I think that would have spoken to Augustus. One of the things that he spends a lot of his reign trying to do is to encourage a return to the old Roman virtues. He does this in a number of ways. Rome, by this point, is afflicted with a trend that accompanies a lot of affluent societies, which is that the birth rate goes way down. He introduces legislation to try to increase the birth rate so that these large old Roman families are burgeoning again. Again, I kind of jokingly said that Roman family trees by this point look a lot like that old pipe screensaver. It's revisiting this thing for the umpteenth time. I still can't keep exactly straight all of the personal relationships because they change constantly through things like divorce and adoption. Right. He tries to do what he can to kind of minimize the kind of flippant attitude that has developed toward the old Roman institutions of the family, which, you know, has kind of a correspondence in legislation nowadays to sort of encourage what we would think of as traditional family values, right, legally speaking. This is undermined somewhat, again, in the kind of gossipy air of Augustus's court by the behavior of his daughter, Julia, who becomes a notorious what's a polite way to put this? Party girl, I guess.
Yeah.
This is maybe the most polite way to put that.
She's the Paris Hilton of the the Roman Empire.
Yeah, that,
the early Roman Empire.
That is an excellent way to put it. Augustus seems to not know about this. He seems to be the last one to know about her behavior, and supposedly heartbroken, sends her into exile for the rest of both of their lives. Some of this, again, by this point, we can have two potential Augustuses emerging in our sources, and depending on which historians you read, they will accept one or the other, and maybe we could bat this back and forth a little bit. Some see Augustus as kind of a cynical manipulator who is very, very keenly aware of what we would nowadays call PR, and very effectively is able to manipulate it to get done what he wants to get done. And the other people or other historians will see him as more or less sincere in all that he's trying to do. I personally lean to the sincere side, but I don't see those two Augustuses as mutually exclusive. I think he was very, very sincere and politically and in PR terms, publicly canny, and knew how to go about getting what it was that he wanted. Politically speaking, these institutions, he tries to, for instance, he passes a number of laws regarding people being late to Senate meetings, which is kind of a minor point to bring up, but it's illustrative of a larger problem. Some people who are of the senatorial class have been skipping out. They don't really take this old duty seriously anymore, in the same way that the Romans had kind of stopped seeing military duty as a privilege. Now senatorial duty itself is kind of getting in the way of the good life. So Augustus tries to encourage and make mandatory attendance at the Senate, and not just attendance, but punctuality. What is actually going on there, though, you know, kind of underneath all of this kind of argument about punctuality, is that as sincere and idealistic as Augustus is, he doesn't realize that the fact that he holds all of this power kind of makes pointless all of the other offices, right? Senators, why should I go to the Senate meeting? Augustus has the power of a consul and a tribune. He can do what he wants, right? In point of fact, again, as we mentioned earlier, Augustus does do a certain amount of honor to the Senate. They can stand up to him from time to time. But the basic intuition that a lot of people of the senatorial class have, I think, is correct. So kind of a cautionary tale for people who want to reform and go back to the good old days. First of all, kind of, you know, have a more realistic image of your good old days, but also know that what you set about doing to try to bring back the good old days is also going to alter. You're not going to get exactly what you want. To that end, you can almost see Augustus's reign as kind of a very long-term case study in the law of unintended consequences, which will become very important when we have less idealistic, less virtuous people holding the power that he has.
Yeah, and I think that's a great way to put it. In sort of practical, in a practical way of looking at it, kind of the number one real world change that Augustus makes happen is all of the political power is now in the hands of one person.
Right.
So in a sense, he's done what he's said he would do. There's no more question of populares or optimates, right? I mean, the factions are gone. And you never again, at least in the Western Roman Empire, have the problem of political parties, right? Factionalism is solved. It's the princeps all the way down.
Right.
In the Eastern Empire, you do have political parties formed sort of after the collapse of the Western Empire. Interestingly, focused on the chariot races, which maybe we'll talk about that. I don't know. So, he's solved the problem that caused the civil wars. You know, that problem of factionalism is gone. But like you pointed out, the institutions are of the Roman Republic are now set on a new road. And I think just a good way to think about it is that prior to the Roman civil wars, it sort of looks like, despite their best efforts, the offices of the Republic are all headed in a direction that is going to end with the consolidation of power and one man rule. I don't see how they could have reasonably avoided that.
Yeah.
Maybe that's just something that will eventually happen to every republic. That's a question for later. After the civil wars, once Augustus is in power, the republican offices are headed in a direction that ends in their own obsolescence.
Right.
Several of these offices hang around even until the end of the empire, but they just drop out of the history books because they are so unimportant. The only reason we even know they exist is because they keep track of the people who fill the offices. We have inscriptions here and there, consul so-and-so who served for a month, in 400 AD,
right.
Did nothing and just got his name carved on the tablet.
Yeah. I mean,
I
was just going to note, if I remember correctly, the city of Rome is still electing consuls even after 476 when,
right.
I mean, it continues
in a very symbolic way.
Right. But it's basically like, my hometown is Tiger, Georgia, right? It's a post office and a gas station. The mayor of Tiger has about as much significance as, the consuls do at that point.
Right. So sort of the two offices, interestingly, the two offices that seem to remain significant all the way through the fall of the empire are senator, because that's where your aristocrats are. So they do, even though they don't have political power anymore, they're still involved. And we'll talk about that. And an office that we didn't talk about called the 26 men,
mm-hmm.
that hangs around, because they're the ones who basically sweep the streets and take out the trash.
Yeah.
regardless of who's in charge, you have to have someone doing that.
Yeah.
Someone has to clean up. So it doesn't matter if you're an empire or a republic. It really doesn't change. But that sort of leads into an interesting claim that Augustus makes. We have a writing from Augustus called the Res Gestae, the stuff I did, that he has inscribed in stone all over the empire. So we have a couple of versions of this. I think one of them is from Turkey, which is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Where he says that he has he's solved the problem of politics for all time. all the world was troubled and broken by faction and people were suffering. And then I saved everything and everyone from destruction. It's good for the nobles. It's good for the common people. Factionalism is gone. And Rome now has a government that's going to last forever. 400 years later, an obscure Christian pastor in southern France named Salvian writes a book explaining how Augustus' plan went wrong. And a less obscure pastor in North Africa named Augustine writes a book explaining that it was never going to work in the first place. Augustus didn't know that, of course.
Right.
He set out to make sure that the civil wars were over. His big concern was guaranteeing that Rome doesn't go through another century of social conflict. So everything he does is tied to establishing a lasting peace in Rome. So how does he do that? And we don't have time to go into sort of full details here. One thing he does, we'll talk about more next time, but he tries to solve the problem of succession. So sort of the pattern that we see with Augustus is he will get sick, name a successor, and then he will get well, and his successor will die.
Yeah.
Put that on repeat 4 or 5 times. He lives to extreme old age. I don't remember if he makes it quite to being 80 years old, but he comes pretty close.
I think he's something like 76 or something like that. I can't remember. He's born the year of the Catiline conspiracy and dies in, what, 14?
Yeah, 14 AD. By the time he dies, basically everyone alive had always lived under his rule. Which there's some argument that's why the Augustan project worked so well. No one was left who remembered the empire.
Right.
Lepidus, I think, was left. And that's pretty much – who remembered the republic. He didn't know that he was going to last that long. So he kept having to come up with, who's going to take over after he dies. And he just goes through several names. So Agrippa is named as his heir at some point. Both of his sons, I think both of his grandsons at some point get named.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, he has to give it to his son-in-law, a guy named Tiberius, who we'll talk about next time, which sort of points out that the Republic is in fact dead because it is Augustus who's picking the next leader of Rome.
Right.
There's no election. It's not the Senate picking this, even though there is sort of a, a nod to that. So the problem of succession from Augustus' point of view is who's going to hold this together after I'm gone. From our historical point of view, that's, hey, he is deciding the Republic is dead.
Yeah.
A second thing he does, he reforms the provinces. He wants to make sure that no one can pull a Caesar, come in from the provinces with an army and take over the whole thing. So a number of sort of detailed political and military restructuring things that he does that I don't know that we need to go into those. And then, as you pointed out, he engages in a lot of social reform, right? He tries to rebuild the Roman character. He wants a people who are too virtuous to try to do what Julius Caesar had done. And then he basically keeps them busy, right? His works project. You say he doesn't build a wall, and that's true on the borders, but man, they build like crazy in Rome. Mm-hmm. Right. He claims that he found it, a city of wood, and he left it a city of marble. I forget what that first phrase is, a city of something or other, and leaves it a city of marble.
Yeah.
So he basically scrubs down most of the city and rebuilds as much as he possibly can. Again, you have the idea of that would have been the responsibility of the elected offices in the Republic. Now Augustus is the one doing that. Did I miss anything there, Jordan?
All I would add to that is, again, militarily, he helps to kind of shore up the empire a little bit. Again, I think a lot of Augustus's project is to kind of solidify and make stable what was kind of growing out of control. And to that end, he does a lot to kind of the so-called Pax Romana, which we can argue about exactly how peaceful that was. But the Pax Romana begins with his reign, and it's this period of, you know, very long relative peace and relative stability within the empire. And as part of that, it has we're just falling all over the Trump catchphrases. Part of that is having a secure border, right? He is able to defeat or at least reach an agreement with the Parthians. There's a very famous statue of Augustus as Imperator, right, in which he's wearing a decorated breastplate. And one of the triumphs of Augustus's reign that is depicted on that is a Roman legionary receiving back from a Parthian standards captured by the Parthians in the defeat of Crassus, decades before. That is part of a project of restoring sort of Rome's honor and dignitas back what it had lost, and these standards have a semi-divine status, not just within the legions, but within the empire itself. They're basically looked at as kind of the physical representations of the numines that accompany the legions wherever they go. So they actually have little shrines to themselves and things like that. We could get into more of that later. But he also tries to set about, you know, neutralizing threats on all the frontiers and making sure that Rome has a defensible border, which is a huge geographical challenge for Rome where it's at. It's got an entire sea in the middle of it, which means that they are stretched all the way around the Mediterranean, and just this stretching of their defenses and their resources is going to be a recurrent theme for the next 400 or 500 years. What he hopes to do is use geographical boundaries, which is kind of a natural way to go about it. He tries to push as far into Germany as the Elbe, which is more or less the border between the former East and West Germanies. I was astonished when I learned that because I was so used to thinking of the Rhine as the frontier. That project ends when the famous incident of the Teutoburg Forest, in which a Roman ally, Arminius or Hermann, betrays 3 Roman legions and butchers them. I think just in the last decade or so, they've actually found the site of what they believe to be at least one of the battlefields of that forest. Augustus, when he's told about it, and this is in his old age, he's certainly in his 60s by the time that this happens, maybe pushing 70. Famously cries out, you know, give me back my legions. This is a military defeat that's just catastrophic. And rather than try to punish Arminius and his Germans, Augustus kind of just puts the nix on military expansionism for a while, because again, that breeds instability. And what he wants to do is kind of shore up what we've already got. So the Rhine and the Danube become this very long riverine frontier in the European part of the Roman Empire. And that's going to last. Those frontiers are going to last basically until the very end, with very occasional incursions into places like Dacia, modern-day Romania, under Trajan later on down the road. But he's going to set that pattern for basically the rest of the empire as long as it survives. And the Rhine and the Danube frontier is going to basically last as more or less as Augustus establishes it until almost the very end. There will be occasional expeditions into places like Dacia under Trajan, or even into Mesopotamia, which is very briefly taken from the Parthians. But more or less, the empire at its height is going to look like it did at the height of Augustus's power. Caesar gets a lot of glory, right, for his conquest. There may not be as much glory in it, but there is just as much honor, I think, in defense. And you know, the Augustus in Boy Scout terms left it better than he found it, which is something that I don't think he necessarily gets enough credit for.
Right. Yeah, and basically by drawing the line and saying, you know, this is as far as we are going to go. With a couple of exceptions, you know, they do take Britain, and like you said, they do take Dacia.
Right.
But by and large, this is the empire, and it's really sort of the natural defensive lines at the time, right? If you think about it, you know, you can't really go very far south. There's that giant desert in the way. Same thing in the east, desert and mountains and those Parthians. And then kind of to the north, you have the frozen wasteland of Germany. And the, you know, Eastern Europe isn't exactly the most welcoming place either. So really, this is as big as Rome could reasonably get anyway.
Right.
So to draw a line around it and say, hey, this is what we're going to do, really makes sense in multiple levels. And I think that sort of leads us into a natural question at the end. What's our analysis of Augustus? Hero, tyrants? Did he destroy the Republic? Did he save it? What are we supposed to do with this guy?
I'll go ahead if you want me to.
Yeah, go for it.
Augustus is, in my mind, really hard to define, because in many ways he kind of solidifies the destruction of the Republic that Caesar began. And if we're going to condemn Caesar for that, I kind of feel like we ought to condemn Augustus for finalizing that. And at the same time, Augustus is such a different personality, and his instincts seem to be so diametrically opposed to his adoptive father's that doesn't seem like quite an adequate response. As I pointed out, Augustus's basic impulses politically seem to be, you know, relatively, again, lowercase c, conservative, trying to conserve and maintain, try to go back to a certain extent to the kind of character traits that made Rome the success story that it was in the first place. He sees those changes, that kind of the affluence of this vast and now very successful and very wealthy empire, and he wants to do what he can to preserve some of the old toughness that made that empire possible. To what extent he was successful, I think, is very, very hard to say, especially given the excesses of his successors. Tiberius, maybe a little bit, but Caligula, very famously, Nero, very famously. The empire that these men are going to rule is going to be an empire of vast wealth and lots of license. If Augustus had been blessed with the gift of foresight to see where his project would wind up, I kind of wonder if he wouldn't have tried to do things differently. But again, I don't know what other reasonable alternative he had. So, I don't know if I would go all the way to say hero, but I also don't want to call him a tyrant either. He was, again, a commendable administrator. Personally, again, it's very, very hard to say what his kind of personal ethics were. There are stories in Suetonius to suggest that he might have been a slightly hypocritical about in regard to some of his kind of what we would think of as pro-family legislation. He's supposed to have had an eye for other men's wives, kind of like Caesar did. Again, the evidence there is really hard to suss out exactly how reliable that is coming from Suetonius. But by and large, he's a much more pious, much more virtuous man than Caesar is, and I think his reign bears the stamp of that virtue, which, you know, even if I'm not going to go all the way to an endorsement, I'm going to say it's at least commendable.
Yeah, and I will endorse. I think there is some virtue to be had in saying, look, we're the Republic is dead. Short of a retreat to the old Republican borders, Short of a withdrawal from all of this land that we have conquered or stumbled into or whatever, those institutions just aren't designed to bear the weight of empire. You can't have two officials ruling for only a year over the entire Mediterranean basin. That doesn't work. Which isn't to say that, it is of necessity that you have an emperor, but I don't have an alternative, and obviously no one at the time did either. So the options seem to have been fragmentation and dissolution or emperor. And Augustus, whether he knew that or not, that's the result. And like you said, it's not to say everything he did was good. Some of the long-term effects of this are very bad, especially when you have bad emperors. We'll talk about that in the next episode. He did the best he could, and he built an empire that lasts for nearly five centuries.
Right.
It lasts far longer than the United States has been in existence. Before we do reading recommendations, application for today. One of the fun, if somewhat futile, questions, I think, is have we had our Augustus yet? Have we already transitioned as a country? Is the United States no longer a republic, and is it now an empire? And if so, when did that happen? Or is that too much gloom and doom? And should we say we're not there yet? So, Jordan, what do you think? You're the historian here. I'll defer to you.
There is grave danger in trying to draw one-to-one comparisons. I think the most relevant. I'm going to, in worship service terms, I'm going to make this a personal application.
Sure.
I think what jumps out to me the most about Augustus's reign is just a kind of cautionary tale. If Caesar is a cautionary tale for revolutionaries, and really radical reformers in the vein of the Gracchi, Augustus should be a bit of a cautionary tale for reforming conservatives. And again, cards on the table, I would consider myself a pretty Burkean conservative myself. I want to kind of, I have that deep respect for tradition, and I kind of lament daily, honestly, the collapse of a lot of the traditions that would previously have mediated our lives and political life, the things that kind of stand between us and politics. Now everything is politics, and I lament that situation. Augustus, I can see kind of similar impulses there again, and he did what he could. But the problem, of course, is that the institutions that he created through his reformations, the pattern that he set was built very much around his own personality. So, there's a tension in his reign in that he's essentially an autocrat who is trying to create a self-reliant people through legislation, there are flaws in the very foundation of that work. He's doing good work, and again, I believe sincerely, but it's flawed, and those flaws are gradually going to kind of bring the whole edifice down. And again, in large part of that, to circle back to what I was saying, is due to the fact of Augustus's own personality himself. He is a good man to have in that kind of power. If you've got to have a man with the power that Augustus has, you would want it to be a guy like Augustus. The problem is that human personalities vary widely, and the next guy to come to power is not going to be an Augustus. He's going to be a pale imitation. The guy to come to power after him is going to be possibly some kind of psychotic monster. So something that is good to remember is that as you are reforming the problems or attempting to reform problems that you see in your own lifetime, obviously you cannot prepare for every eventuality, but you ought to consider, if I'm not the one in charge, what could someone different do with the power that I'm investing in myself or in some other person? Something to consider. I want to say one of the founders, and who exactly it was escapes me at the time. I want to say it was John Adams, criticized some of our own governmental institutions for, as laid out in the Constitution, for basically assuming it's always going to be good guys in charge. Augustus is sort of making the same mistake 2,000 years ago.
Right, which is one of the anti-federalist arguments against
yes.
the Constitution.
It's, yeah, I want to say it might have been Patrick Henry.
Yeah, that sounds right. But it's assuming that we will always have a George Washington in the helm.
Right.
When really we've got an Andrew Jackson coming.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so I'm I'm a little disappointed you didn't go full Southerner on me and just say, you know, Abraham Lincoln. He's the one, well-intentioned, sort of conservative, wrecked the whole thing, you know. But that's one of the names that I often hear kind of kicked around. I don't know if I buy that. You will hear more modern conservatives saying FDR, right? Same kind of thing, right? Had some perhaps noble goals, did some things that were maybe okay, but ultimately established an autocracy.
Yeah.
With the president.
Yeah. You've got the same basic programs under FDR and LBJ, but if you look at the personality differences between the two men, there's just a canyon that opens up between the effects of their administrations.
Right. Or Nixon, for that matter.
He's
obviously not as awful as some of the early Roman emperors were, but
right.
there's still problems there that are pretty serious. I think you're right to be hesitant, though, about drawing those parallels. They're fun. They're a blast to sort of kick around. But at the end of the day, historians 1,000 years from now will have much better perspective on this.
Right. We see our own problems, and some of them loom very, very large, like who's going to use what bathroom, right? Those may be footnotes to future historians, if not left out of the books entirely. Narrative only becomes clear with a lot of teasing out later on down the road.
Right.
Talking about making these parallels, one of my professors, it may have even been the professor who taught me Rome as an undergrad, he liked to say, contrary to what a lot of popular wisdom has it, history does not repeat itself, but it rhymes, which I think is a
right
pretty good way to search for parallels and at the same time acknowledge deep differences.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the Hegel view of history, right, where it's not circular, but it is a spiral.
Yeah.
So there are times when you're close to similar events in history, and then there are times when you're far away.
Right.
But you're moving ultimately to the same point. So just in our last couple of minutes here, reading recommendations, although obviously last time we mentioned some of the Roman Revolution, a lot of those will transfer over.
Yeah.
Any specifically for Augustus or Antony recommendations?
Since we talked some fiction last time, I'm going to do that again. I'll get to that in a minute. I'll start with the factual accounts here at the beginning. I mentioned Tom Holland last time. I mentioned his book Rubicon, and I believe I also mentioned the sequel that is out now. It's still in hardback. I'm waiting for the paperback because I'm poor. His sequel is called Dynasty, and it's about the Julio-Claudian dynasty, which would run from Augustus through to Nero. It's gotten rave reviews. I haven't had a chance to read it yet. Jay Eldred, who's been on a couple of episodes of the Sectarian Review, I see on Goodreads, which is an app that we both have, that he's reading through it right now, so maybe he could endorse it. Again, I'm looking forward to reading it. I haven't gotten there yet, but it's supposed to be a very good history of the world Augustus, intentionally or not, created. I've mentioned Adrian Goldsworthy a number of times. Goldsworthy fanboy. His most recent book is a biography of Augustus, which I read, I believe, last year, and it was excellent. I would definitely recommend it. Along with a couple of the other usual general history recommendations, like Finley Hooper's Roman Realities. I mentioned Michael Alexander as a translator of Cicero. I would definitely check out some of Cicero's work. In fiction, the first thing that comes to mind is Robert Graves. Have you ever read I, Claudius?
I haven't. Does he start with Augustus?
Yeah. The vast majority of I, Claudius actually doesn't have much to do with Claudius.
Sure.
Yeah, there's two books in it's not exactly a series, but it's a book and a sequel. I, Claudius and Claudius the God. Claudius is a distant successor to Augustus, who basically grew up in Augustus's household and managed to survive a large part of the reign of Augustus, as well as the reigns of Tiberius and Caligula. Unharmed, because he was thought to be feeble-minded and no threat. This eventually brings him to the imperial throne with, again, a very, very different empire from that Augustus tried to create. There's a lot of fiction in I, Claudius, especially filling in the gaps. Graves has a taste for the theatrical and the sensational, so you need to understand as you read these books that this is the craziest version of events that you can get. That said, they are hugely entertaining, and they are grounded very, very solidly in history. Graves prided himself on not making up any characters. Every character that appears every named character that appears in the books is a historical figure, whether or not he uses them fictitiously. I really loved those books when I read them in college. I keep meaning to reread them, so I'd recommend them. It's an entertaining way to get a double-barreled dose of the Julio-Claudians. We can refer to that again when we talk about Augustus's successors. And a pleasant surprise that I got this week, I just ran into this book in a bookstore and grabbed it because it was relevant to what we're about to talk about. Augustus, a novel by a guy named John Williams, not the theme song guy. It won the National Book Award in, I think, 1973. I had never heard of it or John Williams. I grabbed it up, and I'm about halfway through it, and it's really entertaining. It's considerably different from the tone of I, Claudius. It's an epistolary novel, so everything is written as if it's a letter to or from someone, or a diary entry or a memoir after the fact. They quote the Res Gestae of Augustus at one point. So far, it is very, very interesting. I disagree with, you know, the historical representation of guys like Cicero, for instance. I love Cicero. Williams apparently didn't. I don't care. Sure. It's a really entertaining book, and it's kind of a gem that I just accidentally turned up this week. So I would recommend that to people as well.
Excellent. I'd recommend the ones of those that I've read. I agree. Those are excellent books. We're finally into the place where we have good historians.
Yes.
So we didn't talk about Virgil or Ovid or Livy, but they are all writing at this time.
Yeah.
Under the patronage of Augustus, until he gets irritated with Ovid and exiles him to the Black Sea. But they're all writing at this time, so they're good sort of windows into what's going on culturally. But we also have historians who are writing about Augustus who are just excellent down the road. So Tacitus and Suetonius are the big two. Tacitus is a senator who's kind of a grumpy old man writing about kids these days being awful, and wasn't it better in the good old days, and has, I think, a fairly nuanced view of Augustus. A negative view, but he is not necessarily unfair. Suetonius is always more fun.
Yeah.
He was an equestrian, I think, right? He was the Senate librarian.
Yeah, I can't remember his exact position. He had connections to a few of the later emperors. He gives actually fairly fair treatment to a few people. I think Otto, who ruled for like 3 months in the year of the three emperors.
Right.
I can't remember. I think his dad worked with him or something. I call Suetonius the National Enquirer of Roman history.
the thing is, he we know that he had access to basically all of the documents, right? Because he worked in the library until they found out what he was doing with them and they fired him. But he basically writes both the historical stuff that the emperors did and all of the scandals involved with them. The prejudice is if there's a conflict between Tacitus and Suetonius, you always go with Tacitus. The problem with that prejudice is Suetonius has better sources and does not seem to have a political agenda. He's just kind of writing what he thinks people want to read.
Yeah.
So
better sources that we know of. There's a lot of Tacitus that's lost.
Well, sure. And that's, we only have part of Tacitus. We only have part of Suetonius for the matter. Both of them write about Augustus extensively. They're both worth reading. Their sections on Augustus are both fairly short. Plutarch would be another guy who writes on, I think, both Augustus and Antony, and most of the other people we've been talking about. So he's worth picking up there. Also, in terms of fiction, I don't know that I have any secondary sources from the time. There's a series of biographies of each of the Roman emperors that are pretty good and that draw on different authors, different historians to write them. I'm blanking on the name of it, but I'll throw that up. In terms of fiction, the movie Cleopatra, not the Elizabeth Taylor version, but the Claudette Corbière version is excellent. The HBO Rome series, the second season, deals with what we've been talking about today. It is not as good as the first season. It's not as accurate, and it's much more full of
which is saying something for
violence
Rome.
And sex. Yeah, well, I mean, I really appreciated the first season. The second one is not nearly as good.
I've only seen the first season, so I'd be interested in checking out the second one.
There are moments in it that are good, they, in part because they're dealing with so much more.
Yeah.
You know, it's not all focused on the city of Rome. They have to sort of travel around. It ends up, I think, trying to bite off too much. So I would say avoid that one. And then there are lots and lots and lots of movies. Of course, we mentioned Shakespeare. So any of those that you run into are usually worth paying attention to. Lots of stuff about Antony and Cleopatra. In the late 90s, there was a whole spate of kind of made for TV stuff about this time period. Some of it is good. Some of it is not.
Right.
It depends on which one you're going in. It's kind of the luck of the draw as to whether or not they're any good. I think was there anything else? There's a couple of biographies of Cicero that have come out in the last decade or so that are actually from what I've heard decent. I haven't read them, but I've heard good things about them. Anthony Everett, I think.
Yeah,
is the,
I read that one. It's probably been 10 years ago now, but I remember being blown away by it. I'd like to revisit it, but you know, you've only got so much time. Based on my memories of it from 10 years ago, I'd heartily recommend that one.
And he has one on Augustus too. Yes. I think that's come out more recently. But I would say the one book to read, and it's unusual that I would say, you know, if there's one book to read that's not a primary source, but I actually in this case am willing to say that this secondary source is better even than the primary sources, is a book by a guy named Charles Norris Cochran called Christianity and Classical Culture. He starts with Augustus and writes through Augustine, tracing both the events and the politics and the philosophy that's going on. I will mention that basically in every podcast we do on this subject from here on out, because it is spectacular, and it is unfortunately basically unknown. There's been a reprint of it by the Liberty Fund, I think, in the last few years, and a friend of mine is doing some Cochrane publishing that's kind of bringing some attention. But this book is just top notch scholarship and top notch analysis. So if you don't read anything else, I would say read this one. Although, of course, the primary sources are important too. You know, the Res Gestae is very short; it can read pretty quickly.
And I'll say I spent a lot of time talking about good fiction today. Definitely give priority to the historical stuff, the factual stuff. The fiction is fun, and it's a fun introduction if you're interested. But if you want the real story, you're not going to get it from Robert Graves.
Right. Although he has some. Some history that's pretty good.
Yeah.
He was really a historian. Like yeah, he's such a weird guy. Didn't he like live in isolation on some island?
I can't remember all of his life story. I mean, he was like his World War I memoir is one of the best I've ever read. Goodbye to All That. He was a classicist. He wrote about mythology. He wrote these novels about the reign of Claudius. I think he had some. Super revisionist modernist stuff on Jesus too, which you know, right. Graves. I think he was involved in. I may be libeling the man. I'm not sure, or maligning him. I want to say he was involved in some kind of very strange esoteric spiritualism that gave a really odd bent to his takes on mythology and also the history of people like Jesus. But yeah, he was a really weird and fascinating guy.
My undergrad classics professor liked to talk about friends that he had and professors that he had who would go on like pilgrimages to meet Graves.
Oh wow!
So they would go, you know, visit his manor in the Mediterranean, and he was, you know, always very gracious about it. But he intentionally lived in the middle of nowhere so that he wouldn't have to see anyone.
I kind of love that.
I mean, there's part of that that's appealing. Part of that that's, you know, very English. We should. We're at our time, so we should draw it to a close there.
All right. So,
in closing, The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in the family and get more information about our own show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please leave us a review on iTunes so that other people can find our show, or like our Facebook page at Facebook.com/CityOfManPodcast. You can also get in touch with us at CityOfManPodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Edward Song and Jordan Poss, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.